The EU's Brexit negotiator is also calling for patience, saying a new trade pact with Britain is still possible this week.
Ça fait à peine 9 mois que nous négocions.
Trade of goods and services, fishing, energy, transport, the security of citizens. Never have we negotiated such an agreement in such a short space of time. We've only been negotiating for 9 months.
The EU says that Westminster has to compromise on fisheries, but the UK says it cannot be the only country in the world that does not have sovereign control over its fishing waters. Neither seem prepared to budge, and despite a new deadline, it seems a no-deal Brexit is more and more likely. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listener of Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, we invite you to listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
My dear brothers and sisters in Iman, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. As we continue in our series that we began looking at the 10 Islamic commandments for a healthy life, and so we continue in our discussion by looking at the second commandment of the 10 that we want to cover. And that is the commandment to be good to our parents. Whatever they do, the sins that our parents do, that's between them and Allah. If you as a young man or woman cannot encourage the good, cannot forbid the evil, cannot help your parents out of that situation, their accountability is with Allah. But our accountability is with our parents. We still respect them. And actually, it's at such a level where at the time of one of the latter khalifas of the Banu Abbas, the Abbasid dynasty, one of the khalifas who was obviously, and they were all corrupt, Banu Umayyah, Banu Abbas, there were very few people who were in charge of authority that were good people. Other than Umar ibn Abdul Aziz, all the other khulafa were pretty much corrupt. One of the latter khulafa of Banu Abbas, he had a son, he had multiple sons, but one of the children was a respectable man. He loved the Ahlul Bayt. He detested to hear his father curse Amirul Mu'mineen, as was the tradition of those khalifas, so-called khalifas. They would insult the Ahlul Bayt. They would curse the family of the Prophet. They didn't think anything about it. But this one man had a bit of a sense of understanding that what his father was doing was not right. And he hated to hear his father curse Amirul Mu'mineen. And he went to the Imam, he's either the 7th or the 8th Imam, or maybe the 9th Imam, and he told the Imam of the situation. He says that this is what my father is doing. He's the Khalifa, but he's also my father. What do I do about it? Can I kill my father? And the Imam was telling the man, he says, of course you can't kill your father. At the end of the day, he's still your father. However evil and wicked and corrupt this man is, you can't kill him. But he pressured the Imam. He kept asking and asking and asking the Imam. This is what my father says. This is what my father does. He's literally outside of the fold of Islam. And the Imam says, you know what? If you need to do it, go ahead. But realize that one of the outcomes of doing this act is that you are going to shorten your lifespan. Because there is a rule in Islam of cause and effect. Just like in the world, right? You throw something up in the air, it'll come back down. It's a rule that God has put in, gravity. There's a rule that if you respect your parents, you'll live a long life. There's a rule that God has put in the physics and the mechanics of this world, in the spiritual realm of this world. You do good to your parents, you'll get it back, right? What they call karma in this society. But you don't do good to your parents, even if they're wicked, you'll still pay the price. Even if what you're doing can be sanctioned by the religion. So the story goes that he killed the father, he took over the throne. He didn't last for more than a few months and he was dethroned and he himself was killed. But he did what his responsibility was. Now don't go and do this at home. Right? This is a man going to the Imam of his time, the representative of Allah. So he had sanctioned by the Imam. We don't have that, right? So we have to deal with our parents, young or old, whatever they are, in ways that we have been learned, we have been taught from the Quran and the hadith of Ali Muhammad, alayhi wassalatu wassalam. Let me just give you one other story about the level of parents, right? Just to show us, before I go more into this, the role that parents have in our lives. When you look at the role of the mother, she carries the baby, the child, the fetus in her womb, and she goes through the difficulties of not only childbirth, but you know, sleepless nights and not being able to function normally during the pregnancy. It's a difficult time for women, for most women. And then after the birth of the child, most of us who are fathers in this room, we probably sleep through the child's first few months. Right? We're sleeping while our wife is awake feeding and changing the diapers and taking care of our children. And we men have it easy most of the times. But one time a man comes to the sixth Imam, Imam As-Sadiq, peace be upon him. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. And he had just performed the Hajj. And I'm sure many of you have performed Hajj. You know today how easy it is. Everything's air conditioned. You have water everywhere. You have McDonald's. If you want to grab a bite from Burger King or KFC. But back then in the day, it wasn't that easy. This man does the Hajj with his mother on his shoulders. Can you imagine? Right? Today, if you go for Hajj, you can pay people to carry the elderly on the Hajj. But back then, he carried his mother on his shoulders 7 times around the Kaaba. One time it would tire the most energetic of people. Carries his mother, does the entire tawaf 7 times. Carries her from Safa to Marwa. Takes her from Mecca all the way to Arafat, Muzdalifah, Mina, all the way back. Again, today you have trains and buses and the high-speed trains that go back and forth. He does all of this with his mother on his shoulders. He comes to the Imam and asks the Imam. He says, Ya ibn Rasulillah, O son of the Messenger of God, I've gone for the Hajj, carried my mom on my shoulders. Have I fulfilled her rights as a mother upon me? You'd think, well, obviously, you've done so much for your mother. The Imam came back with a powerful statement. He says, you know when you're in your cradle and she rocked you 1 time to try to get you to sleep? He says, all that you've done doesn't even recompense for 1 rocking of your cradle. SubhanAllah, can you imagine? 1 rocking of the cradle to put a child to sleep. How much effort does it take from a mother? 1 finger, you can push the cradle. But the Imam says, all that you've done on that one Hajj doesn't even repay back that one action. So imagine everything else our mothers do. They carry us in their womb. They deliver us in difficulties. They feed us from the milk that Allah has provided to them. They take care of us. They see us off to school. When we go to a new school, they might walk to us to the front door. They'll see us through every stage of our life till we get married, till we have our own children. And then, unfortunately, some of us have the audacity to insult our mothers, to disrespect our fathers, to mock them, to call them names, to forget about them, to put them up in an old folks' home, in a senior's home, as we do in these societies. And maybe on the day of Eid, we'll go and see our mother or father at the senior's home and maybe bring them some baklava or some sweets and say, Mom, it's the day of Eid. Here's some sweets for you to eat. Meanwhile, they're in a home eating God knows what, not being able to pray, not being able to read Quran, not being able to come to the majlis of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And all of that they did for us, we throw it out the window because now we're married, we have our family, we have our career, we have our vacations to take, we have our beach resorts to go to. And so, brothers and sisters, we have to realize the role that our mother and father have played in our lives and continue to make for us. Just the one dua that our mother makes for us, who knows how much that is worth in the light, in the sight of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
In the limelight.
For Pfizer's coronavirus vaccine was proved highly successful in clinical trials last month. The company offered the Trump administration the chance to lock in supplies beyond the 100 million doses. The pharmaceutical maker agreed to sell the government as part of a $1.95 billion deal months ago. But the Trump administration, according to people familiar with the talks, never made the deal. A choice that now raises questions about whether the United States allowed other countries to take its place in line. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Sharon Lafreniere, Katie Thomas, and Noah Weiland. The piece is titled, Trump Administration Officials Passed When Pfizer Offered Months Ago to Sell the U.S. More Vaccine Doses. Stay with us for more of Sharon Lafreniere, Katie Thomas, and Noah Weiland's article. Pfizer's coronavirus vaccine was proved highly successful in clinical trials last month. The company offered the Trump administration the chance to lock in supplies beyond the 100 million doses. The pharmaceutical maker agreed to sell the government as part of a $1.95 billion deal months ago. But the Trump administration, according to people familiar with the talks, never made the deal, a choice that now raises questions about whether the United States allowed other countries to take its place in line. As the administration scrambles to try to purchase more doses of the vaccine, President Trump on Tuesday issued an executive order that proclaimed that other nations will not get the U.S. supplies of its vaccine until Americans have been inoculated. But the order appears to have no real teeth and does not expand the U.S. supply of vaccine doses, according to a description of the order on Monday by senior administration officials. The vaccine, being produced by Pfizer and its German partner, BioNTech, is a two-dose treatment, meaning that 100 million doses of the vaccine is enough to vaccinate only 50 million Americans. The vaccine is expected to receive authorization for emergency use in the United States as soon as this weekend, with another vaccine developed by Moderna also likely to be approved for emergency use soon. Britain, meanwhile, began its vaccination drive on Tuesday, 8th of December, using the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, making it the first Western nation to start mass vaccinations. On 11th of November, 2 days after Pfizer first announced early results indicating that its vaccine was more than 90% effective, The European Union announced that it had finalized a supply deal with Pfizer and BioNTech for 200 million doses of the vaccine, a deal they began negotiating in months earlier. Shipments could begin by the end of the year, and the contract includes an option for 100 million more doses of the vaccine. Asked if the Trump administration had missed a crucial chance to snap up more doses for Americans, a spokeswoman for the Department of Health and Human Services said, "We are confident that we will have 100 million doses of Pfizer's vaccine as agreed to in our contract, and beyond that, we have five other vaccine candidates." The U.S. government was in July given the option to request 100 million to 500 million additional doses of the vaccine. But despite repeated warnings by Pfizer officials that demand could vastly outstrip supply, and amid urges to pre-order more doses of the vaccine, the Trump administration turned down the offer, according to several people familiar with the discussions. In a statement, Pfizer said that any additional doses beyond the 100 million doses of vaccine are subject to a separate and mutually acceptable agreement, and that the company is not able to comment on any confidential discussions that may be taking place with the U.S. government. The bulk of the global supply of vaccines has already been claimed by industrialized countries like the United States, Canada, Britain, and various countries in Europe, leading to criticism that people in low- and middle-income countries will be left behind. The United States has declined to participate in a global initiative called COVAX that is meant to make a vaccine available globally to all populations. The decision to issue the executive order by Donald Trump was reported earlier by Fox News.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Iran Today.
This is a poem sung to the river Araz, or Aras, which ran through the north of Iran about a couple of hundred years ago. Today, it is the waterline dividing Iran and what used to be its ultra-north provinces.
And that is how a poem struck this chord. It's a reminder of exactly that separation, and it was recited by Turkish President Erdogan at a Baku parade. A victory parade celebrating a ceasefire agreement between Armenia and the Republic of Azerbaijan, an agreement that allowed Azerbaijan to reclaim control over broad swathes of Nagorno-Karabakh and surrounding lands. Now, how did it get there, and why did Erdogan recite that particular poem in celebration? For answers, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today.
Today's map portrays an Iran bordering all three, Turkey, Armenia, and Azerbaijan. So when decades-long fighting reignited in September between Armenia and Azerbaijan, the war spilled into Iran by proximity alone. On top of it all, Azerbaijan gained the upper hand, partly because with Turkey, it stationed at Iran's borders both its archenemy Israel and Takfiri Syrian terrorists. So the way Turkey helped was no favor to Iran, and why it was so eager to help Azerbaijan was questionable. Mr. Parkayin was ambassador to the Republic of Azerbaijan. He shared his thoughts with us at his souvenir-packed house.
This poem directly provokes ethnic sentiments and questions the territorial integrity of the Islamic Republic of Iran, while promoting a kind of pan-Azerism and, in Mr. Erdogan's own words, pan-Turkism. After Mr. Erdogan recited the poem, sensitivities arose in Iran.
Azerbaijan is an Azeri Turkish-speaking republic ripped away from Azeri mainland, which is Iran's northwesternmost province today. So when Turkey's first man sang a song of separation between the two Azerbaijans, it sounded like he was calling for Iran's Azerbaijan to pull away to join its long-lost sister, the Republic of Azerbaijan, and then Big Brother Turkey, forming a pan-Turkic alliance. Iran wouldn't claim being Big Brother to its long-lost former provinces and Khanates. So why would Turkey do so, or did it? Turkey explained Mr. Erdogan's mistake, as in he must have misunderstood the poem. I asked Mr. Parkayin what he thought the Turkish president meant.
What do you think of Erdogan's recitation of that specific poem?
One of the reasons for this discussion is Erdogan's expansionist and ambitious view of reviving the Ottoman Empire. Of course, he targets what he calls Turkish-speaking countries and tries to unite those nations under the leadership of Turkey. Well, this idea, formed in 1991 after the collapse of the Soviet Union, gradually went out of the picture and was not welcomed by Turkish-speaking countries, because these countries believed that now that they had abandoned their big brother, the Soviets, they were not interested in submitting to Turkey as another big brother.
Folks were shocked at the poem recited at the parade. Question is, what was Turkey's first man doing at the Baku Victory Parade to begin with? Mr. Kakai is an IRIB analyst with the capability of splitting hairs, which is typical. He came to Press TV studios to share his thoughts.
Azerbaijan organized the parade exactly a month after the Russian brokered peace agreement was reached with Armenia. Holding this parade means a celebration of victory, a propaganda technique that is used for both domestic and regional use. This was a change that came about after 30 years.
What the poem actually says, what it is actually doing, is that it weeps for both sides, both for Iran losing a part of itself and also for that child that was taken from its motherland. In other words, if anything, it is wishing the lost parts of Azerbaijan back to Iran, to its motherland, and not the other way round. But the pan-Turkic movement misconstrues the meaning, redirecting it to drive dissent in Iran and create a new country. As if there aren't already far too many borders created less than a century ago in this part of the world. Look at Israel and newborn states south of the Persian Gulf.
As for how Iran's north, that's areas north of the Aras River, was ripped away from this country, it followed the Russo-Persian War. In concluding that war, the Qajar dynasty of Iran felt its hand forced to sign the Turkmenchay Treaty in 1828. That followed the also notorious Golestan Treaty of 1813. Turkmenchay saw Persia or Iran cede control of several areas south of the Caucasus to Russia, those areas being the Iravan and Nakhchivan Khanates and what remains of the Talish Khanate.
With the Treaty of Turkmenchay, the boundary between Russia and Persia, or Iran, was set at the Aras River. With the dissolution of the Soviet Union, those states were cut loose, and Iran recognized their sovereignty. Never mind Eastern Caspian states lost to Iran thanks to Russia and its development into the Soviet Union. However, Iran has a very 21st century outlook to the issue, unlike Turkey, it would seem. We had to make a bit of a trip to meet Mr. Rezvanpour. It was worth it, as you will see by his comments.
It was the ineffectiveness of ruling of Qajar Amin dynasty to protect Iranian territories in the face of a Russian invasion in northern Iran. You see, in Fatali Shah area, we saw that by signing two treaties, Gulistan and Turkmenchai, we lost more than 200,000 miles of our territories to the Russian Empire. So we just lost our territory to Russia, and after that we just witnessed different kinds of consequences by losing these territories.
Iran summoned Turkey's ambassador to Tehran Friday. That's the day after the Turkish president's remarks, which Iran said support a secession of Azeri parts of Iran. Not just that. Earlier in the day, Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif had tweeted, "President Erdogan was not informed that what he ill-recited in Baku refers to the forcible separation of areas north of Aras from Iranian motherland. Didn't he realize that he was undermining the sovereignty of the Republic of Azerbaijan? No one can talk about our beloved Azerbaijan. Turco-Iranian ties are solidly unbreachable. But can't Turkish foreign policy damage Iran's ties with other regional states? Here's the answer.
It does not seem to be the case, meaning that Turkey does not have this power. It considers its own influence so it can strengthen its position in the region. But Iran's relationship with Azerbaijan is a distinct one that is based on other considerations, interests and commonalities. This can't be ignored. Therefore, Turkey is unlikely to be capable of disrupting these relations. During the Karabakh War, there were many talks of Takfiri groups being deployed to the region. But this is one side of the issue. Another aspect is Iran's view on this matter. Iran cannot accept a change in the geopolitics of the region or its ethnic situation. For example, changes to the borders or conditions that would threaten Iran's national security will be unacceptable for Tehran. Iran won't tolerate it.
But the Turks appeared as offended as Iranians, given Iran and Turkey have embassies in one another's territories and could have used them as a means of communication, rather than tweets and media accounts. Both countries did eventually summon the ambassadors.
There's more to be said on Iran's regional policy centering on the Aras and Caspian region. Also on how Iran and Turkey handle the case of the explosive poem. But first, a quick media review with Shahzad.
Hi, my name is Shahzad Manateri, and we'll be reviewing the latest update on the Iran-Turkey dispute, Iran's unwavering protection of sovereignty. The Daily Sabah reports, Erdogan says, Turkey-Azerbaijan alliance to continue to overcome challenges. As long as Turkey and Azerbaijan have each other's backs, the countries will continue to successfully overcome challenges, President Erdogan said during a victory parade in Baku celebrating the recent liberation of Nagorno-Karabakh over three decades of Armenian occupation. I believe Azerbaijan will continue to make history under the presidency of Ilham Aliyev, Erdogan said, congratulating his Azerbaijani counterpart on the victory. He called on Azerbaijan and Armenia to rethink relations, as nothing can be gained under the Western imperialist goading. IFP News claims Iran ready to keep Karabakh peace, reconstruct Azeri region, says President. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani has expressed the country's readiness to play a role in maintaining a ceasefire between the Republic of Azerbaijan and Armenia, and to take part in the process of reconstruction in the recently liberated Azeri lands. The president also expressed satisfaction with the cessation of a recent war between Baku and Yerevan, the liberation of occupied Azeri territories, and the establishment of a ceasefire. Pointing to Iran's proposed plan for the settlement of the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict and deployment of special envoys to Russia, the Republic of Azerbaijan and Armenia President Rouhani voiced the Islamic Republic's readiness to play a constructive role in maintaining the truce between Baku and Yerevan and ensuring stability in the region. Jin Huanet states Iran's foreign minister urges regional dialogue to settle issues. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif called for a regional dialogue to settle regional issues. In a Twitter message originally in Arabic language, Zarif said, "It seems that some neighbors are asking the West to be part of the negotiation process with Iran. However, Iran will not negotiate with the West over the regional issues," he said, adding that Western interventions have been a cause of problems for the region. Iran is always ready for dialogue with its neighbors, and it has already proposed mechanisms for regional security and peace through regional talks, he said. That's all for this segment.
Turkish Foreign Minister Çavuşoğlu called his Iranian counterpart a couple of days after the incident. That would be December the 12th, when he assured Zarif his country respects Iran's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Both countries expressed their resolve to effectively implement their bilateral decisions on the basis of mutual interests.
I believe that when we discuss Iran-Turkey relations, there is a solid background and a stable relationship between the two sides that is strong and ever-growing. We must avoid explaining the bilateral relationships by focusing on the roles the two sides are playing in the region, as they are both partners and rivals. Both have their interests and considerations in the region. It's only natural that every country makes decisions with regard to its own interests and national security. But Turkey and Iran are two important countries and players in the region and have good relations with each other, and that's unlikely to change in the future.
Another motive for Turkey's regional policy and alliances is its growing isolation and a combination of broader geopolitical factors. Factors such as Iran and the Caucasus, which are making for a fresh bid to normalize Turkish-Israeli ties. We have some top-notch experts on tonight. Mr. Khashe joined us in the studio. Wish you could ask him anything directly on the Caucasus and Iranian relations.
There are long-term strategic relations as well as loyalty between Iran, Turkey, and also Azerbaijan. Why has Turkey brought Israel into the equation?
Turkey's relationship with the Zionist regime can be analyzed from several aspects. From a regional point of view, they have some kind of common goals and interests and are not in conflict with each other. The link between all this is at the regional level, and that is the Islamic Republic of Iran. They look at Iran as a regional competitor. They also have identified their interests and areas of activity in the region, especially in the Caucasus. For example, the Zionist regime imports energy resources from the Republic of Azerbaijan. These resources pass through the Turkish territory, for which Ankara charges a fee. Turkey also controls the pipelines. The two sides cooperate in other areas as well. There isn't a single issue over which the interests of the two would conflict, nor is there anything that would put them in front of each other.
Iran, apparently unlike Turkey, believes that regional development requires security and stability in the region. Stability is paramount to preventing the entry of trans-regional forces such as Israel and the United States into the region. Israel has established itself in West Asia, but even Muslim Asian parts surrounding the Caucasus are a far cry for it. However, they border on Iran and Russia, those states, and that is strategic for Israel militarily as well as economically. Do notice, by the way, the support Azerbaijan received from Israel and Turkey in contrast to Armenia. Azerbaijan has a wealth of oil, Caspian oil, which Armenia does not.
What exactly is Israel after in the Caucasus, getting involved in the Armenia-Azerbaijan conflict, etc., etc.?
The Zionist regime has various goals in its presence in the Caucasus and the Republic of Azerbaijan. The main priority is the shared border between the Republic of Azerbaijan and Iran. It's important for Israel, as Iran's number one enemy, to have a base near the Islamic Republic of Iran. Israel's other goals in the region involve oil resources. As you know, 40% of the Zionist regime's energy sources are provided by the Republic of Azerbaijan. The third point is that the Zionist regime views the Republic of Azerbaijan as an arms market, and major contracts have been concluded between the two sides.
To Iran, foreign meddling in its affairs is nothing new, albeit it has to remain constantly alert. The unity of different Iranian ethnic groups has always been a target for the country's enemies. For example, the British took measures to create divisions and then separate parts of Iran, such as Herat and later Khuzestan. Mind you, the ethnic minorities I'm out to name are hardly ethnic, but many of their members have been made to think so by those very foreign powers. This would help divide and rule this country, although they haven't gotten beyond dissent, those powers, and that too, not with whole ethnicities.
Talking of pan-Turkism, how Turkish are the Azeris really, at least the Azeris of Iran till today? How Turkish are they for them to be stirred as Turks?
First of all, talk about their religious background. 95% of Azeri population are Shiites, Shiite Muslims, okay? And most of them are, the followers of 12 Imam in Shiite, Islamic calendar. But regarding the ethnicity, regarding the language, yes, they are certainly talking Azeri, not Turkish, okay? But Azerbaijan is trying to make itself closer to the Turkish, ambition of making one nation, one country with two nations. It was the motto of President Heydar Aliyev.
Turkey tries very hard to represent the peoples of Central Asia and the Caucasus as the same as the Anatolian Turks and the Ottoman Turks. But these countries do not accept it. In the Republic of Azerbaijan, for example, people are more attached to Iranian Azeris than to the Turkish-speaking people in Turkey. We do not even see this as a threat. We regard the presence of Azeris in the Republic of Azerbaijan, along with Iranian Azeris, as an opportunity for cooperation and development of bilateral relations. That is why we have abolished visas, allowing Azerbaijani citizens to easily travel to Iran and visit Azeri-speaking areas. Some of them have families in Iran, and on the contrary, some Azeris have acquaintances on the other side of Aras River.
Azerbaijanis or Azeris have of late been introduced as the second most numerous ethnic group among the Turkic peoples after Turkish people. And the world's largest number of Azeris live in Iran, followed by the Republic of Azerbaijan. So you can see how the ground is fertile for dissent.
In fact, the Azeris in this country are well aware of their deeper roots, and they have fought hard and fast for Iran against the Ottoman Empire in the 16th century. Going way back in time, Azerbaijan is an Iranian, not Turkish or Uyghur stronghold. In fact, the Median prophet Zoroaster is said to be of that region. Zoroaster, the monotheist prophet who upheld fire as a symbol of wisdom and purity. In fact, Azerbaijan or Azerbaijan means protect or protector of fire. Azer means fire in Persian. Even if Erdogan had the best of intentions by choosing the Aras poem, how dangerous can it be? What would be the implications in this region?
By pursuing nationalistic ideals, they are trying to just make a division. You see, President Erdogan made this statement in order to shore up the support of Iran Azeris, but he didn't get any, result, because he made a mistake. And after that, it showed Iranian officials a strong disapproval of President Erdogan's statements. But I think that, there is a hand of foreigners which are trying to interfere between the Iranian and Azeri and Turkish relationships in order to just make a discord
Iran has both maintained its own post-World War unity and has made great efforts for the security of the Caucasus by unity and neighborly behavior. In fact, in the conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia, it tried to take a position for fewer people to be killed and for peace to return to the region faster. Iran both exports gas to Turkey and has large imports coming in from Turkey. And the two states have a security cooperation going to counter terrorists present in the region, such as PKK and PEJAK. And this doesn't read with Turkey now facilitating ISIS or Daesh dispatches to Iran's nearabouts. One could say Iran's strong reaction to the Turkish president is to protect the Irano-Turkish brotherhood, because to Iran, territorial integrity is its birthright. It is so ancient that its beginnings have blurred, and territorial integrity is again maintained by stability and national unity. But then, perhaps at worst, Mr. Erdogan just sought to undermine Tehran-Baku relations by addressing sensitive issues such as the bonds between the two sides of the Aras River. That would not make it any less unfair or disloyal. Turkey would do well to remember Iran's position during the coup era, as Azerbaijan should remember how Iran stressed its territorial claim to the Nagorno-Karabakh district in its war with Armenia.
There was a time when even Erdogan's original allies were against him, and almost everyone had come to the conclusion that he was leaving. Nevertheless, the Islamic Republic of Iran stood by Erdogan. This was because of Iran's principled doctrines. Iran always supports the territorial integrity of countries. It supports governments that are legally recognized. This is not a tendentious position, but one based on the principles and norms of international law. Accordingly, the Islamic Republic of Iran upheld these principles and supported Erdogan as the legitimate president of Turkey.
Iran's position towards Turkey has been favorable all along, as with the latest coup. Turkey doesn't seem to be returning the favor. However, it is questionable whether Turkey actually needed help in reeling in a coup.
Turkey's approach towards its domestic and foreign policy underwent a dramatic change following the failed coup nearly 4 years ago. Inside the country, many journalists, political, civil and social activists were arrested. Even the European Union heavily criticized Turkey. This way, Turkey used heightened security measures from within the country, which meant more restrictions for the Kurds and different dissident sectors, groups and parties. In the field of foreign policy, we have witnessed an increasing tendency towards militarization on the part of Turkey over the past 4 years.
That's it for today. Thanks for joining us in our story of the Aras and its pure pastel green waters and the lands surrounding it, Armenia and Azerbaijan, the Republic of Azerbaijan to the north and Iran to the south. Not to forget Turkey, Iran's northwestern neighbor. Bye for now.
In the limelight.
A new analysis conducted by the Pew Research Center finds that the U.S. rural areas that are sparsely populated now account for about twice the number of coronavirus-related deaths as the most densely populated cities. An average of 3 people are dying each day in congressional districts where fewer than 5% of residents live in dense concentrations. Districts where more than 40% of residents live in urban or dense suburban neighborhoods are suffering an average of 1.5 deaths each day. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Reid Wilson Ryder. This article is published under the heading COVID-19 Death Hit Hardest in Rural America. Here's the details of this article. The fall surge of coronavirus infections and deaths related to COVID-19 has hit hardest in rural areas across the United States of America that had largely been spared the worst of the initial waves in April and June as healthcare systems in smaller communities struggle to keep up with so much sickness. A new analysis conducted by the Pew Research Center finds that the U.S. rural areas that are sparsely populated now account for about twice the number of coronavirus-related deaths as the most densely populated cities. An average of 3 people are dying each day in congressional districts where fewer than 5% of residents live in dense concentrations. Districts where more than 40% of residents live in urban or dense suburban neighborhoods are suffering an average of 1.5 deaths each day. That figure is a stark reversal from the first wave of infections, when big cities like New York, Boston, New Orleans, and Detroit suffered the brunt of the disease. Between March and May, U.S. congressional districts where more than 40 and 90% of residents lived in urban or dense suburban neighborhoods lost an average of 5.7 people each day, while the most rural districts suffered 1.1 deaths on an average day. Both the number of deaths and the number of cases is rising fastest in areas President Donald Trump won in 2020 and Republican congressional candidates carried in 2018. That may be a function of geography. Republicans perform better in rural areas, while Democrats do better in urban cores. It may also indicate that those living in rural areas are less likely to abide by recommendations from health experts to avoid social gatherings. We have people that are less likely to take precautions, and we have a lot of pandemic fatigue going on, said Amesh Adala, a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. A lot of people have given up. The diffusion from an urban core rippling out to suburbs, exurbs, and then rural areas is not unexpected. It mirrors familiar patterns that epidemiologists see with seasonal influenza, which might be introduced into and spread rapidly through cities, especially with a hub airport, and then filter more slowly through less densely populated communities. The fall surge has infected far more people than the two zeniths prior, but no state has been able to escape record levels of illness and death. More than 1% of Americans tested positive for the coronavirus in November alone, according to William Frey, a demographer at the Brookings Institution Metropolitan Policy Program, a figure more than twice as high as any prior month. The early perception that COVID-19 was only impacting places somewhere else and that adopting measures such as wearing masks, observing social distancing, and eschewing large gatherings need not to be followed is no longer credible, Frey wrote. Nearly 300,000 people in America have died of coronavirus-related causes, a toll that far exceeds any other country. 16 million people in America have tested positive for the coronavirus, though the true number of infected is likely multiplies higher than that. A Epidemiologists and public health experts worry about a surge of cases in rural communities in the U.S., where health systems are smaller and more likely to be teetering on the brink of financial disaster. In earlier waves, that was more concentrated. Hospital staff could deploy to the hardest hit epicenters across the U.S. Now, as the virus spreads uncontrolled everywhere, healthcare workers are becoming an increasingly scarce commodity. You can always create extra beds. We have step-down units. We have post-op recovery units. We have actual surgical suits that can be turned into ICU beds, said George Rutherford, an epidemiologist at the University of California, San Francisco. What we don't have is the staff. Many smaller facilities are shipping the most severe coronavirus cases to larger medical centers in nearby urban areas, but even those medical centers are beginning to fill. You're going to see rural hospitals be the canary in the coal mine, Adiola said. Many of these bigger hospital systems are being much more rigorous about who they accept for a transfer. More than 109,000 people in America are currently hospitalized with the coronavirus, according to the COVID Tracking Project, a group of independent researchers. That number has doubled since Election Day. Phrase analysis shows the highest per capita case counts happening in non-metropolitan areas, where nearly 18 in every 1,000 people were infected in the month of November. The per capita infection rate in urban cores stood a little below 12 per 1,000. Infection rates are the most substantial in rural counties, where a higher percentage of residents are minorities, and where more than a quarter of residents live in poverty. In both cases, those counties recorded new per capita case counts far higher than the national average, Frey said. In 54 counties where more than 80% of residents are Black, Hispanic, Asian American, or Native American, infection rates are almost three times higher than the national average. In 226 counties where more than a quarter of residents live below the poverty line, concentrated in non-metropolitan areas in states like Kentucky, Mississippi, Louisiana, Georgia, and Texas, infection rates have been higher than the national average since May.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech from IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. Please stay tuned. In Ayah 191 of Surah Al Imran, we find that Allah states some attributes for those who possess intellect. In the words of Quran, those who remember Allah while standing, sitting, and lying on their sides reflect on the creation of the heavens and the earth. Such people are considered to be wise and of wisdom because in any moment and in any situation, they consider Allah in their lives. Allah, through this verse, is also admiring the true possessors of intellect. In fact, in the view of Allah, the true possessors of intellect are those who see the signs of Allah everywhere and confess that these are all created ones by Allah.
خب در اوصاف امیرالمومنین علیه السلام نوشتند که وقتی که از خواب بلند می‌شدند.
It is mentioned in history that every day when Imam Ali alayhi salam wakes up in the midnight for tahajjud prayer, he used to read verses 190 and 191 of Surah Al-Imran of the Quran. Through these verses of the Quran, Imam Ali alayhi salam could be more attentive towards the signs of Allah around himself. Also, the late Mirza Jawad Agha Maliki Tabrizi, the outstanding Shia mystic, has suggested his students to read these verses of the Holy Quran, especially when they wake up during midnight. He even advised the people to do this before taking wudu or ablution, because this recitation of the verses will prepare your hearts for midnight and morning prayers. Therefore, ayahs like these refer to the importance of remembrance of Allah. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
IRIB English Radio.